Hello, satellite sisters and misters. Join us on Sunday, April 11th for a very special Satellite Sisters virtual event to celebrate 20 years of sisterhood.
All five sisters, Julie, Liz, Leanne, Monica, and Sheila, will share stories and recollections. There'll be an interactive audience quiz, Q&A, and lots of laughs, and probably a few tears, because this is Satellite Sisters.
Thanks to our friends at Sixth and I for hosting this event. For more information and tickets, visit satellitesisters.com and click on the awesome celebration graphic right there on the homepage. Okay, let's do this together, sisters. 3, 2, 1.
Bring your satellite sister.
And we'll see you there.
You're listening to Satellite Sisters.
What's a satellite sister?
The person you call when the best thing in your life happens or the worst.
The person that gets you up, gets you going, and gets you through.
And every once in a while, changes your mind.
This podcast is part pep talk, part weekly check-in.
Like grabbing coffee with a friend.
Thanks for being here. Welcome to the Satellite Sisterhood.
You are listening to Satellite Sisters. Great to be with you today. I'm Leanne Dolan here in Pasadena, California. I'm a writer and producer, and I'm just a little sad that they unstuck that big boat because I was enjoying all the memes. I mean, those were fun. There were some fun big boat jokes. Okay. Liz, what's up with you?
You just wanted that to go on forever. It's the total distraction factor, right? Yes. This is Liz Dolan. I'm in Santa Monica. I'm the middle sister, just hanging out here in my office / second bedroom. I'm good. I'm good, Leanne. How about you, Joel?
I'm here in Dallas, Texas. This is Julie Dolan. I'm the oldest sister. I'm the urban nana, the grandmother with five grandchildren. I am making a special guest appearance this morning in my granddaughter Alice's closet. And I'm going to explain what I'm doing here in a little bit.
Okay. I hope you could explain it to your grandchildren. It's really not us that's the problem. But
it is a little odd that the grandmother is in the closet. Yes.
But there you go, Joel.
We carry on. Yes.
Setting an example for the younger generation. Just nothing stops you. Nothing stops the podcast. I love that. Well, speaking of that, today on the show, we're going to be talking to British writer Andrew Morton. You know, he is a biographer of the royals. He's done biographies of Diana, for instance, and he has a brand new book out today called Elizabeth and Margaret. Julie and Liz, you both read the book and you enjoyed it. It said
fabulous.
It's quite a stunner about royal siblings.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's about sisters, Lee. And even if they weren't royal, you know, it's complicated. But the fact that they are royal makes it so much more complicated. Thank goodness we are not princesses.
I think we should ask Andrew Morton to write a book about the satellite sister.
I don't think you want that. I don't, because
I'll tell you, Leanne, the facts that he has in his new book are amazing. That's, you can't believe with all you know about the royals that you don't know the things that are in his book.
Yeah, agreed.
Mm-hmm. Okay, I'm looking forward to the conversation with Andrew. That's going to be great. Also coming up, Julie, you're bringing us some college admissions information, facts, and opinions.
Yep.
Is that correct?
2020, the pandemic has upended college admissions. But don't worry, I have a whole new system to solve the college admissions problem.
You've been hard at work in that closet. Good work.
Yes.
Good work, Nana. Good work. All right, we're going to talk a little bit about pandemic anxiety over reentry, like what it's going to be like to go back to real life. Are you ready? What are you nervous about? I have a short list of things I'm never going back to, so I'm going to share that. But Liz, what's happening with you this week?
Well, you know, Leanne, I'm still getting over that broken leg and broken knee. Remember that? That happened at the end of December. So my focus for 2021 has been little victories every day, right? So here are my little victories for this week. Before, you know, the current even more unpleasantness, I was doing Cooking with Liz, yes. And which is hard when you've only got one good leg, right? So then I've been doing some experiments with cooking for Liz. And so this week I had...
That's funny, Liz. Good work. I like it.
So I had success in both of those areas this week. These are my little victories. And the cooking for Liz, you know, Mama Capra's marinara sauce won the sauce of the summer on Cooking mm-hmm. with Liz.
Mm-hmm. The best. So, yeah, that is absolutely
it's delicious. So I had a helper who helps me here in the afternoon make up a batch of Mama Capra's marinara sauce, which made me very happy. And then on Sunday, I made, Julie, remember you told me I should learn how to make Ina Garten's turkey meatloaf?
Yes, it was our mom's favorite. Yes, yeah. And you did make that on cooking.
Yeah, okay, I didn't make that this weekend. What I did is I made up that turkey, whatever, the recipe, and made turkey meatballs. And myself, I cooked some turkey meatballs. So I had cooking with Liz was the turkey meatballs, cooking for Liz was the marinara sauce. That was my dinner Sunday night. It was, well, it was even more than a little victory, but it was at least a little victory. It was yes. great. It was great. So there you go. Little progress. That's all I need every day.
That's good, Liz. I hope you, did you really knead up that meatloaf mixture? Because I felt like on the first episode of Cooking with Liz.
Well, Julie,
I didn't mention it at the time, but I just mention it now. Okay.
A lot of these recipes tell you not to overwork it. But anyway, that's okay. Why I didn't, there was no video of this because I didn't want any commentary from my sisters.
Okay. Liz, I think it is a big victory. And I just, to eat a home cooked meal is a great thing.
It is. Yes. Okay. A little victory.
My situation, as I said, I am here in my granddaughter Alice's closet, which is surprisingly very neat and well organized. And the reason I am here is because of a pandemic provoked project. Sisters, have you had any home improvement project that has been provoked by the pandemic? Leon?
Well, we did turn the guest room, which was sort of outdated, into an office. So we did do that. So that was helpful. But mainly, it's just a list of things I want to do when the pandemic is over and we can leave the house.
Okay. Which is what you want to...
Oh, well, I want to do... First of all, I want to burn every stick of furniture we have or recover it.
Okay.
Okay.
You've made the most of all that furniture. You've maxed it out.
I mean, I feel like we have made the most of every square inch of our house, and we just need to like sage it, smoke it, burn it out, and start again. I mean, honestly, even like the throw pillows are bugging me now. Like, I cannot take this throw pillow one more minute. So,
okay, well, Leon, then you understand exactly where I was, because for me, it is my walls. I have been staring at those walls, at the walls in my house for a year, and I can see every mark, every chip, every smudge, all the dirt from the dog, and I just couldn't take it anymore. So at first I started just doing a little touch-ups by myself, which was a really bad idea.
Oh, that's so like our mother. Oh,
I know,
my gosh.
And I am a terrible painter. I'm just a terrible painter. So I just got to the point where I was like, okay, the entire interior of my house is going to be painted. It needs it. I just could not stand it another day. So that is the project that is going on in my house. That's the reason I have left my house, because unlike the Lowe's and the Home Depot commercials that I've watched for a year, you know what those are, where they throw up some blue tape and then they take a roller and start painting wildly in all directions, you know, right?
Is that right? Yes.
It looks fun. Looks fast and easy. Fast and easy.
Right, Liz. And then 5 minutes later, they're sitting on the couch looking at you, in my humble opinion, some horrible color that they've painted the living room wall. But nonetheless, that's not really what happens when you have the interior of your house painted. Is you have to like empty out your house pretty much, and you have to get out of the house definitely. So we have been staying with our son and daughter-in-law, and that's why I'm in the closet. So little public service announcement. It's not exactly like the commercials, but I think the end result is going to make me, it's got to lift my mood. It's going to be a mood booster, no doubt about it, to have fresh walls. So
What color are you painting it? What's the big color?
White.
All white.
White.
You're very brave. Yeah,
I know.
Very brave.
I know. Liz, how about you? Do you have...
So I want to go just the other way, Julie. Every wall in my house is white. And I've been spending a lot of time laying in bed, as you know, just staring at my bedroom walls, thinking, okay, I got to go with a bright color, a focus wall, whatever they call those things, maybe wallpaper. It's just all I think about is got to ditch the white and go with color. And which is, I'm sure, something I'll regret in about a year, but that's my instinct. Color. I need more color in my life.
I think there are a lot of pandemic provoked projects going yes. on. It's been a year. We can't take it anymore. Right.
Well, I think about like what a poor job I've done cleaning over the last year. I mean, and so the idea that there are going to be other people in the house besides my husband and son, I'm like, wow, we got to start now for cleaning for 4th of July. If we can really have people over 4th of July, I got to get into some nooks and crannies right now because, you know, normally I have at least a couple of big events every year where you get things organized. Oh gosh, yeah. People are coming over. Oh, it's Thanksgiving. It's this, it's that. Those are big home improvement areas in our house, timeframes. Yeah. None of that's happened. So we've let some things slide. So besides burning everything down, I have to clean everything up. So
is that the order? You're going to burn it and then
I don't know.
Clean it and burn it.
I don't know, but I don't think we're alone. I think a lot of people feel like
paint, it's worth it to hire the painters for, in our case, it was because we're so terrible at it. So,
okay. Well, Julie, we had something pop up on the Facebook this week that I felt like I was experiencing, which is, you know, pandemic anxiety over re-entry, right? Ooh. About what is it like now people are vaccinated? What's it going to be like going back to, you name it, going back to the grocery store or the movies or whatever it is. And I'm starting to experience that, but I think there are a couple things I want to just get out there that I'm never doing again. If the pandemic has taught me anything, it's this. I am never wearing uncomfortable shoes again. Like, it's over.
Yeah.
I am going to be one of those people that show up in clogs at a formal event. I don't care. I don't care anymore. Like, I had to put on heels to dance in last week for my dance lesson. I could barely stand up in 2-inch heels. I was like, oh, I can't believe this is happening. I haven't worn shoes like this in a year. You know what? I don't even care anymore. I just like comfortable shoes. I don't feel like I need to be uncomfortable for anyone. It means I'm going to have to shorten all the pants I have, you know, so all the work pants I have are, you know, rely on like a 2-inch heel. I don't know. Yeah. I'm going to the flats.
I think this is one where the sisterhood needs to stay strong with each other, Leanne. I'm with you. Let's just all agree that we're going to do this. Okay. If nobody goes back to high heels, there won't be any social pressure to go back. Let's just all do this together.
Good idea, Liz.
I don't know. I'm not on board. I want to wear a pair of heels again. I know.
You have thin feet. That helps. I think that helps. You have pretty good feet, Joel. Okay. Two, I am genuinely worried I'll never be able to stay up past 9 p.m. again.
I'm with you, Lillian.
Oh my gosh. Like, I think I'm going to start turning down things that start after 7. Last night I had to do an event at 7 and I was like, how am I going to stay up? Like, I'd be on at 7 p.m. Our whole body clock is now like, we're getting up at 4:30 and we're like falling asleep, like really old people at, you know, 7:30 on the couch. It's just all wrong. But I also don't have any desire to stay up past 9. So I'm concerned about that. Okay. And then my last big concern. So my husband and I got vaccinated this weekend. We were happy to do that. Very
Congrats.
Happy. Thank Great you. Plan. The J&J vaccine. All good. And I am concerned now that we will run out of conversation because the last year we have been having like our own panel discussions on the pandemic, the causes, the mask wearing, the vaccines. Like, we go off, get our own news sources, then we bring them together and then we rehash them at night. Like, when we walk the dog on Saturdays, we have a small think tank about all things pandemic. What are we going to talk about now? I'm really worried.
Worried. Yeah, and you've already watched everything on Netflix, which is why you're going to bed at 9 o'clock, right? So you can't, there's not that.
Well, we've watched the first half hour of every episode on Netflix.
Excellent.
But one thing I remain terrible at, I have not improved at all over the pandemic, is takeout. I'm still very bad at takeout. I don't enjoy it. I order poorly. It makes me stressed out. I don't know where to park. I'm tired of doing takeout on the apps. So I'm looking forward to inviting small groups of people to the house for dinner. Yes. It means I'll have to clean, but it will be worth it because
clean and burn.
Yeah.
There won't be any place to sit down for dinner at your house, but
I know.
But you have that nice counter in the kitchen. So yeah. People could just huddle around the kitchen.
Yeah, I won't burn that. You know, though, it's funny. Yesterday, I got a survey from Golden Voice. That's the group that does Coachella and a couple of other music festivals that I've been to. So they wanted to know if I would take a survey about, am I ready to go back to music festivals or music events? And I was procrastinating. So I took the survey and the questions were like, what would it take for you to come back? Like, would you need temperature checks? Would you need all the employees masks? Would you need, you know, all the people masks? I'm like, yes to all these things. Oh my gosh, am I really ever going to go back to a music fest? It kind of made me sad, you know? Mm-hmm. And I noticed that we had a post on Facebook from a listener who said she just really had some anxiety about getting back to normal. She was relieved at getting vaccinated, but she just didn't know if she could go back to normal again. And many comments, you know, hundreds of comments on it. People really, you know, echoed her sentiments that they were just going to be taking baby steps to head back to Trader Joe's for the first time, or they didn't want to start overscheduling themselves like they had been, or some people weren't planning any changes in behavior. They had gotten vaccinated, but they were still going to stick with their plan till the fall or the winter. Others were like, you know what? I'm going back to silver sneakers and I'm ready to get out. As long as I'm masked, I'm fine. And then someone said this, and it's true. Someone said, I'm just not ready to hug yet. No. And I felt that. Okay. I was like, I think the social interactions are going to be awkward.
Yeah.
How do you guys feel?
It's interesting. I was talking to my grandson. He's already planning for the next pandemic and some of the stuff he wants to do during the initial lockdown.
That is sad.
Isn't that? He said he really wants to lie down in the middle of a busy street. He missed it on this pandemic, but he said, the next time, Nana, that's the first thing I'm going to do. And I thought that is pretty poignant about
that's good.
About anxiety, right? Uh-huh. Yeah, about how people think. Liz, what about you?
Well, my worry is that because during the pandemic, you know, obviously everything has been optional. You could say no to anything. If people needed you to do something, or you're obviously not going to go anywhere, you don't have to show up anywhere. You can just say no, no, no. I'm worried that getting to yes with me is going to be hard. I'm just going to just keep saying every time somebody asks me to do something, no, sorry, can't do that.
Right.
So, you know, picking and choosing what's worth the effort is going to be challenging. I feel differently than you about the hugging. I'm dying to start hugging people. And
okay.
Yeah. And when people tell me that they've gotten vaccinated, I have this overwhelming desire to hug them. But I haven't. But I'm looking forward to the day, as long as they flash their vaccine card.
No, I read that Staples is laminating them for free. So
this is a public service announcement, because UPS told me you are not supposed to laminate your vaccine cards because the information can get smudged during the lamination process.
Thank you, Julie. Okay. That's important information.
That was the CEO of UPS told UPS stores to distribute that information to elderly people, because those are the only ones laminating.
Yes, and then hanging them around our necks.
I mean,
okay, see, I'm gonna hoard that information and save it to tell my husband. That's gonna be exciting.
Okay, that
now is, I have something to tell Barrick.
Yeah.
Okay, well, yeah, I think people do share a lot of this anxiety. It will be interesting how it reveals itself and over what period of time, because we got the whole rest of the year.
Right. Still a lot of question marks out there.
A lot of question marks. But I have an event that everyone can say yes to, sisters, and this is the Satellite Sisters live event on April 11th. Mm-hmm. Are you guys psyched?
I am getting psyched. We're doing some prep work. Yeah, it's going to be fun.
Yeah, we are actually preparing for this. That is true, Leon. That is true. So on April 11th, which is a Sunday, we're celebrating 20 years of sisterhood. Last year was our 20th anniversary. As a matter of fact, this week, April 1st, will be the official 21st anniversary the first Satellite Sister show. That's so that's good Thursday. Point. Everyone can celebrate in the privacy of their own home, but we want to see you on April 11th. So if you haven't bought tickets yet, you know, what are you waiting for? We're selling a lot of tickets. So go to satellitesisters.com. We almost never mention our our website, which has everything you would ever want to know about us, but it does exist. And if you go there to satellitesisters.com, right on the homepage, there's a link that will take you to the Sixth and I platform. Sixth and I is the great cultural institution in Washington, D.C. that is hosting this. We had hoped to be there live on their stage, but not going to happen. Anyway, so get your tickets. And you can be on the show if you buy a ticket, because we are looking for one solid gold satellite sister or mister to be on camera during the show, where we will test your mastery of satellite sisters trivia. Right. So we're just putting this out there. If you've been listening since the public radio days, are you up to date on the current podcast? Do the words Officer Rubbish mean anything to you at all? Well, then we have a Google form that you can fill out, and we're going to pick a winner from everyone on the Google form. We'll put the Google form in the show notes. We'll also distribute it on social media and post it on our website.
And Sixth, then if you've already bought tickets, you'll be getting an email with a link to the Google form from Sixth and I.
Right. This week. Right. Right. Okay. Right. And so maybe you'll get picked to be our special contestant on April 11th. So it's a random drawing. We will have to do a little tech check with you before the event. There will be a participation prize. My copy here says, oh, Leon, good idea.
Thank you, Liz.
But also, to get people super in the mood, we want you to join us in a toast. So on the show on April 11th, we will be toasting all of you. Nobody is more important to us than our listeners. So we had family mixologist Leon's son, Colin, concoct a special cocktail for the celebration. It's called the Golden Buzz, right? Ooh. So, yes. So Leon, you must have been in on some of the Golden Buzz testing.
Yes, we did that this weekend after I recovered from the J&J shot. I would like to say, it's an inspired cocktail, and it is golden. And that's, yes, you are golden to us, satellite sisters, solid gold sisters. And that was the inspiration.
Okay, so we are going to post the recipe and also teach you how to make the drink in an alcohol-free version of the drink in the Satellite Sisters Facebook group live on Friday, April 9th at 5 p.m. Pacific. So that's 8 p.m. Eastern. So it's called a pre-party, people. That's what we're doing. We're going to do a little Friday night pre-party to get you psyched for the Sunday event, which is 4 p.m. Pacific, 7 p.m. Eastern. And Colin is going to teach Leon and I how to make the Golden Buzz. So,
right.
So what's in it, Leon?
The primary liquor is rum, is dark rum, which is why you get that golden color. Okay. But he's also going to make a version using gin if you're more of a gin person. So he'll give you two versions of the cocktail, and then I'll do an alcohol-free version of the drink as well that night. Yeah. Yeah. We're just,
well, yeah, we can make three drinks is what you can. That's
good.
Three drink good. Minimum. I like
or
that.
No drink. We, I guess we don't, no drinks. We're just happy. We're looking forward to the whole week. Yeah. Uh-huh. Yeah. So there you go. So the best thing to do is buy those tickets now, because then you'll get all the emails and all the information through the ticketing forum there at Sixth and I. So if you if you haven't purchased your $12 ticket yet, now's the time to do it. And then you'll get all the information about coming on the show, or you'll get the drink recipe, everything like that. Right. But we're looking forward to it. Yeah. I got some work to do this week.
Yeah.
But I'm looking forward to it. Okay. All right. Speaking of what we're looking forward to, Andrew Morton is coming up. He's a royal biographer. He happens to live in Pasadena, so I see him around town, so I know him. So, you know, we put this interview together quite a long time ago. His publicist emailed like, hey, Andrew would love to be on the show, and you all had just watched The Crown, and it seemed great. We just had no idea there was going to be so much royal family news, but, you know, we're going to be talking about sisters Elizabeth and Margaret and the Windsors, and we look forward to it. He, you know, he wrote that book about Diana, so that got, you know, that was it was comprehensive, and we read that. And so now we're going to be talking about Elizabeth and Margaret. So stay tuned. Up next, Andrew Morton.
Liz and Leanne here, and we are so grateful to have Osea support Satellite Sisters. Why? Because it's just a great product. Holy cow, do we love Osea's skin and body care. And you know what? This Mother's Day, just look no further than Osea. Spoil the moms in your life with the little luxuries from Osea. The moms, the stepmoms, the bonus moms, the people who bring a touch of something special to your life, aunts, grandmothers, they would love a little Osea this Mother's Day. And you can get 10% off your first order by using our code SATSISTERS at OseaMalibu.com. And Liz, you know what every mother and mother figure needs?
What?
More moisture, Liz. They need more moisture in their skin.
No kidding. I mean, really, the creams, the lotions, the oils, I love it all. That duo they have going, like, you can't miss with the duo of Osea.
Liz, the mega moisture duo. Yes. You can literally see your skin get firmer, and it just delivers this full body glow. Okay, you know we have raved about the Undaria algae body oil. Mm-hmm. Well, pair that with the Undaria collagen body oil. Youthful, yeah. Liz. Your youthful glow is going to happen. And it's infused with Osea's signature Undaria seaweed. So it just smells so delicious, doesn't it?
I know you're talking about giving it as a gift. I also suggest just giving it to yourself because you're worth it.
That's true. That is absolutely true. Okay, that moisture duo I mentioned too is a great value because you can save 16% plus the extra 10% with our code SADSISTERS. So this is it. This is a win-win-win Mother's Day gift. Spoil the moms in your life with clean vegan skincare and body care from Osea. Get 10% off your first order site-wide with the code SATSISTERS at OseaMalibu.com. And you get free samples in every order and free shipping on orders over $60. Osea is spelled O-S-E-A. So head on over to OseaMalibu.com and use code SATSISTERS for 10% off. Thanks, Osea.
We are back and we are welcoming Andrew Morton to Satellite Sisters. He is the author of Elizabeth and Margaret, The Intimate World of the Windsor Sisters. Andrew, welcome to Satellite Sisters. We can't imagine anyone doing the book, An Intimate Portrait of the Satellite Sisters, frankly.
Thanks for inviting me. You never know. As we always used to say when we were raw reporters, it's a long corridor.
And today's your publication date, so congratulations. But I will confess that our interest in this story really is not so much about royalty. It's more about the shocking concept that one sister would have control over another sister's life. Like, there is no Dolan sister who would buy into that construct. So,
except for me, Andrew, this is Julie. I'm the oldest sister, and that seems like it could happen, you know.
Yeah, and so I mean, presumably, as you were reading the book, you were reflecting on your own lives and your own relationships as well, because a lot of it is common sense, isn't it? That the eldest sister has a certain personality. The second one occupies a psychic space left by the other. And I think you see that vividly with Elizabeth and Margaret, that mm-hmm. Elizabeth was the sensible one, the cautious one, the one who, you know, who made sure, woke up in the night and put her shoes back together so that everything was neat and tidy. Very anal, use that kind of word in the 1930s, whereas Margaret was the mischievous one. You know, disobedience is my joy, she would say, and she loved making people annoyed with her and then twisting them around her little finger.
But between the sisters, did they just grow up accepting that Elizabeth was going to be Margaret's boss? I mean, it just seems like it's one of the weird things about monarchy, honestly.
Well, I think what is interesting, quite frankly, is the fact that initially one was a princess, the other one was a princess, and there was no difference at all because everybody expected that David, or Edward VIII as he became, would marry and have children. And so, and if that had happened, Elizabeth and Margaret would be lost to history, and they would have been, married some genteel aristocrat, lived in a stately home with horses and dogs and a small brood of children. So what happened in 1936, the abdication, changed forever the relationship between Elizabeth and Margaret. And I think this is the interesting part of the book, in the sense that they changed from being sisters to being, as you mentioned earlier, the boss and subject, or the monarch and subject, where Margaret had to curtsy and pay all kinds of obsequies to her older sister.
Yeah, Leanne, can you imagine us curtsying to Julie? I mean,
no.
You know, Andrew, we've seen The Crown. We've read Anne Glenconner's book, The Lady in Waiting. So I felt like we knew a lot about this. And what is so excellent about your book is you have so many more details, particularly about this period when, you know, when the abdication happens and the big change in their life that goes on. How did you get access to so many details? Because it's so vivid and it was so new to read.
Well, just comprehensive research, really. I mean, yeah. Marion Crawford was the governess of the two children. She wrote a book called The Little Princesses. And what I did, I dug into the papers relating to that seminal book, which was published in 1950, and they're held in America. I got to read those and harvested a whole raft of material about the girls.
Yeah, that really comes through. You have some great stories about Elizabeth. Of course, one of my favorites, and I need to check with you today. Did Queen Elizabeth really use a high heel to crack the shell of a creme brulee dessert one night?
That's the level of detail Andrew has in this book.
That would just knock me off.
I love that story, that you've got the Queen sitting there and everybody's trying to manfully break the icing on, is it the icing, whatever it is, the glaze on the creme brulee.
Yeah, the shell of a creme brulee. It's hard.
Hard. I mean, it does take a pneumatic drill from sometimes. And give it a whack. But the point I was making there was that she was with her people, horse riding, horse racing people, the kind of equine aristocracy. And she wouldn't have done that, say, if there'd been a bunch of artists and bookworms there. They were more Margaret's cup of tea.
Mm-hmm.
It's that sense that the Queen isn't always the Queen. She can be quite, you know, casual.
Yeah, that sounds very good.
And you know, just to kind of finish that point off, it's very interesting during the whole year of lockdown with COVID, that the Queen has used social media very adroitly. And you see her very dry sense of humor emerging in some of these interactions. You know, she was presented with a statue by some Australian university the other day. And she was saying, well, I wouldn't like to meet that person coming out of a foggy night. You know, it was just her humor is very dry. And it's often overlooked because it was Margaret who was the one who came out with the punchy one-liners who had everybody laughing.
Yeah, yeah. Well, one thing I definitely took away from your book, Andrew, is that sibling drama playing out in the tabloid press is kind of a multi-generational thing with these Windsors, you know? So I never understood how much of that was in play with Margaret's romance with Peter Townsend. There's so much in the book about her being hounded by the tabloids about making a decision and doing all of that, but the drama between the sisters and then what we're seeing play out right now, the drama between the brothers. It's just family drama on this royal tabloid level.
Absolutely. And it's not just a tabloid level, it's a broadsheet level as well. I mean, fascinating the way that story unfolded, because Elizabeth was put into a very difficult position from the get-go. She's only just inherited the crown from her father. She never anticipated becoming queen so young. She's only 26. And here she was having to decide whether her sister could marry the man she loved. I mean, it was a tremendous burden to undertake at that relatively young age. And also, with a prime minister, Winston Churchill, who was, you know, world-renowned statesman, war leader, hero of the hour, how dare she even enter the same room as him, really, in a way. She was very nervous about that. So it was a very difficult family situation at a very critical time in Elizabeth's reign.
Yeah. I mean, Andrew, you know, you write about their affair and their love, and you have a very different account of what happened than what we've all seen in The Crown. What was your take? Did the relationship just, you know, sort of run out of steam, or do you think they gave up because of all the external pressure on their relationship?
You know, I was guided in this from a book I wrote before. My previous book was called Wallace in Love, about Wallace Simpson. Mm-hmm. During the abdication crisis, she was in the south of France, staying with friends, and she had no control over what was being decided in London that would affect the rest of her life. And she was telling Edward VIII, do not abdicate, do not abdicate, on the phone, on her phone calls every night. But of course he abdicated, and she was the one who was blamed, as it always happens. It's always the woman who's blamed. And it's a remarkably similar story with Margaret and Peter Townsend, but it is the obverse. She was the one who was in control of everything, of all the information. She spoke to Eden, the Prime Minister. She spoke to her sister, the Queen, and it was made clear that all she had to do was relinquish her place in the line of succession. She wouldn't have to give up her civil list, the money that she was paid. She wouldn't have to live abroad. She would obviously, if she was to marry a divorcee, who was Group Captain Peter Townsend, she'd have to marry outside of a church. But that was all. But as I discovered, he remained blithely ignorant of that, even after the event, and even nearly 30 years later when he wrote his biography. So it seems to me that she was playing it out as a grand romance, when actually she'd actually moved on. And mm-hmm. there's an allegation as well that she, at the time, she was having an affair with Eddie Fisher, the singer and bon viveur.
Mm-hmm. But, you know, there's so much in your book. It feels like what we've just observed in our lifetimes is that the system kind of ground Margaret down, and then the system kind of ground Diana down, and now it's starting on Meghan, for whatever reason. There are all these theories about that. So my number one question is, does the institution ever learn and change? Has the firm or the family, or have they learned anything from what happened to Margaret and then Diana?
Well, the Queen said after Diana's death that the lessons will be learned. And then,
yeah, I know.
Said with Meghan, lessons will be learned. But it is it's a tougher, what people don't appreciate, and nobody appreciates really, unless it's a very tough gig being a member of the royal family. You're on display, mm-hmm. you've been commented on, you've in a way your humanity is squeezed out of you. You've just got to become a symbol, and I think that's one of the issues that all these new arrivals into the royal family face. Diana did, I mean, and remember she gave it 10 years before mm-hmm. she jumped ship, and also her husband was in love with somebody else, so mm-hmm. that's a very different kind of story. For Margaret, she was often lost and alone, because you have to carve out your own niche, and she did it to a degree, but she wasn't as successful as say, for example, Princess Anne. She's a tougher, more aggressive individual. She hitched her wagon to Save the Children Fund, a charity of which she was patron and president for a time, and she's made a good fist of being a member of the royal family. But you look at, and I was thinking about this the other day, you look at Catherine Middleton. She spent nearly 10 years in the public spotlight since she got married. But before that, she had a long, long runway to get to know what it was like being a royal. But even so, even after, 10, 15 years of this, I feel that she's only just really come into herself as a woman, as a princess, and as a communicator, and I think that it just does take a long time, and that is the top and bottom of it. And if you don't have the patience for it, or the will, or the need, then It's a daunting.
Yeah, it sounds awful.
Right. Yeah. I mean, you know, I think one of the things you that comes through in your book is I had so much empathy for Margaret because she got terrible press. You know, I mean, some of it may have been deserved, but a lot of it wasn't. Andrew, what do you think Margaret would say to Meghan? How do you think those two would interact?
Oh, good question. Yeah, Mal, you're absolutely right. I mean, I would extend the fact that all royal women get terrible presses at some stage or another. I think Margaret would just say, "You've got to stick at it," and certainly give it more than the year that Meghan gave it, and think about it a bit more. I mean, you know, Margaret had a terrible press, and as she says in the book, the narrative of her life: one sister must be good and the other sister must be the font of all evil.
Yeah.
And she was defined as the evil sister. And I think it's just, there's a combination of the narrative of a member of the royal family. Once it sticks, it sticks. And the narrative with her was that she went off, you know, to the Caribbean, which she did in the winter. Everybody in Britain shivering their asses off and, you know, jealous as all hell about somebody going off to the Caribbean in the days when, you know, long haul flights were very, very exotic. And she took up with a guy who was 17 years her junior, Roddy Llewellyn, a jobless gardener, researcher, handyman, you know.
Oh, I've dated one of those.
Yeah. Every sister in any family, you've had at least one of those.
Yeah.
And he was the original toy boy, and she was the original cougar.
Right.
But at that time.
A role, yeah.
People weren't talking about toy boys and cougars. And so she went against the mainstream thinking. And it's, I mean, now, of course, younger men and older women is a common occurrence, but in those days not so much, and she fell out badly with the Queen over her romance with him, and the Queen only really recognized the fact that Roddy had been very, very helpful to her, especially towards the end when she suffered several strokes, and she realized that, you know, he had made her happy, and and who can say more than that?
Well, okay, so I want to end on this note, get your advice on something. So, because your book is about how the two sisters, Elizabeth and Margaret, they, you know, try to stay loving siblings with all of the pressure of the monarchy. So now we see the two brothers struggling with the same, right? So we're very pro-sibling relationships here at Satellite Sisters, Andrew. Yeah. So any advice for William and Harry from you, or that you think their mother would be giving them now?
Well, I think their mother would be very concerned, because she always said to me that Harry is William's backup in the nicest possible way. Mm-hmm. And as any mother would, it would be, it's, you know, what's the phrase, that you're only as happy as your unhappiest child? And she could probably see that the body language of Harry during his interview was kind of aggressive and rather morose. You could see that he needed some assistance, and that William too is probably very hurt by some of the things that Harry said about him, about being trapped and not really fulfilling his true nature. So there's a big chasm between the brothers at the minute. And I think that the spirit of Diana will have to come into play at some stage. And I think probably the first time that will happen will be when the sculpture of Diana, which was commissioned by the two boys, is unveiled at Kensington Palace Gardens in July, and that may, and the whole world will be looking at the body language there. I mean, you know, Harry might not even come, because Meghan might be having her baby number two, the baby girl that is promised.
Mm. Wow, that is Shakespearean. That
yes, it is.
Bill's thinking of that. It's at least a one-man play by Tom Stoppard. That scene right there.
Well, if it's about brothers, it's probably a two-man play.
Okay, good point. Thank you. Although.
Well, thank you so much, Andrew. Andrew's book is Elizabeth and Margaret, The Intimate World of the Windsor Sisters. So, of course, that that got our attention. But basically, Andrew, you've reinforced our fundamental belief that it's a good thing we're not royals. We would not.
I don't think we'd last 10 minutes.
No, yeah. No. There's just no chance we would buy into that whole structure. So thanks so much for joining us today, and congratulations on your pub date.
Thank you, and very nice to talk to the three of you.
That's good. No, we're out. No, I was in. Yeah, I just, we with three of us asking questions, it's too much. So the interviews is just two. So Andrew, thank you. That was great. We appreciate it.
That was great, Andrew. It was a wonderful book. I'm recommending it to all my friends. Yeah.
Right. Many thanks. And as Leanne told you, that I told her to put more sex into her.
Yes, he was the one. That's that uh-huh. great. It was like, now your mother's dead. Put more sex in. I appreciate that. I think of you every scene. Is that wrong? Probably.
Well, I hope not.
All right. I'm coming to see you at the Valley Hunt Club in April. So I'll see you
then.
Right.
Oh, great. I'll see you then. Okay.
Okay. Thanks, Andrew.
Thanks. Bye-bye.
Bye, Andrew. Bye. Okay, bye.
Hey, it's Liz and Leanne here, and we want to thank PROS for supporting this episode of Satellite Sisters. Now, you know, Liz, I've been out and about with my new book, The Marriage Sabbatical. Mm-hmm. The book is getting rave reviews. I'm very happy. But you know what else is getting rave reviews? My hair, Liz. My hair from PROS is getting rave reviews.
Leanne, I am not surprised. You have been on that PROS hair regimen for quite a while. I mean, you have good hair anyway, but now you have great hair because you've really paid attention to it.
Well, Liz, PROS is made for people, not hair and skin types. Personalization is rooted in everything they do, from their in-depth consultation to their made-to-order model. And you know what? I love the regimen they have me on. Do I take the hair vitamins every day? Yes, I do. Do I use my shampoo and conditioner made especially for Leanne Dolan? Yes, I do. I sometimes use the leave-in conditioner when my hair's really dry? I do. And I even have a pre-scalp thing that they give me. Okay, PROS, you're the boss. I'll take it. You tell me what my hair needs. That sounds good. And here's the thing. It's personalization, Liz. For millions of possible formulas, only one is uniquely Leanne's. Okay? And I'm using it. PROS isn't just better for you, it's also better for the planet, Liz. They're a certified B Corp, cruelty-free, and the first and only carbon-neutral custom beauty brand. So PROS, we love you. I love the photos of my hair. Couldn't be happier.
Photos of your hair. There are people in the photos, too. That's the thing about a book tour. Everybody has their picture taken with Leanne and then post it. So the hair is important.
Couldn't be happier, PROS. PROS is so confident that you'll bring out your best hair and skin. They're offering an exclusive trial offer of 50% off your first subscription order at pros.com/sisters. So you get your free consultation, then 50% off at pros.com/sisters. And PROS is spelled PROSE, pros.com/sisters. Thanks, PROS.
Okay, we are back. Well, that was great talking to Andrew. So much interesting information.
So much detail.
Yeah.
He's an expert.
He is. He's absolutely an expert. Liz, speaking of books, were we speaking of books? Because I just wanted to mention.
Don't you have a new book coming out like in 10 minutes or something? Yes, you do.
It's the same book, but in a new format, Liz. And that's
exciting. It's new.
Okay. The Sweeney Sisters, if you haven't read it yet, or if you haven't given it to everybody you know, now's the time. Because The Sweeney Sisters is coming out in paperback on April 6th, very soon. Mm-hmm. And it is available for pre-order now. I want to thank all the Satellite Sisters Street Team members who have been out there promoting the book in various ways on their social media. I cannot thank you enough. It's super helpful to me to spread the word of The Sweeney Sisters through people like you, genuine readers and people who enjoyed it. So I appreciate it. Now's the time, The Sweeney Sisters, advance pre-order, lots of information on our website, but anywhere you order your books or any indie bookstore you want to walk into and pre-order, that would also be awesome. I appreciate it. Thank you, Satellite Sisters Street Team. Thank you. Also, Liz, just quickly before we get into the college admissions discussion, just a salute to Beverly Cleary and Larry McMurtry, who died last week. Mm-hmm. You know, at Beverly Cleary at 104, Larry McMurtry at 84. These were some lions of, you know, American writing whose work affected millions of people. I mean, you know, it's one thing when you're a children's book author, like, and you write stuff that really sticks with kids. Why is it that I guess the children's books we read over and over again,
yeah, right?
We just internalize them, or someone's read them to us, so we remember them. And so you just don't forget characters like Ribsy or Ramona, or like the Mouse and the Motorcycle was my favorite of the books. And I could read, you know, that to the boys when they grew up. It's just such a lovely legacy to have and to pass on. What an amazing woman Beverly Cleary was. She was a librarian that then became a novelist. And she just seemed like a lovely woman, and that she was from Portland, Oregon, and incorporated Portland into all her stories was charming. And then Larry McMurtry, you know, he was a prolific writer and screenwriteer, everything from, you know, Brokeback
Mountain. I reread some of his books, Liam, since I've moved to Texas, and they're just even more meaningful now that I live here, that I see the landscape that he wrote about. I mean, he, you know, and he was so incredibly popular too.
Yeah.
People that may not have been big readers read his books,
right?
Because of the tales. Yes,
everybody read Lonesome Dove when that came out, like the mid '80s. I read it and moved to Wyoming. I mean, that's how profound it was for me. Yes. Literally, yes. I literally did. So it's a good. That's a good Lonesome Dove. It would be great if it was the summer of Lonesome Dove. It would be a good book to revisit this summer, especially if people are doing a lot of road trips instead of flying. If you're driving around the American Southwest or the West, pick up Lonesome Dove or listen to it on tape. I bet there's a good version.
That would be
great.
Oh, that would be good for a car trip. Excellent.
Yeah, it would be good. So anyway, cheers to both of them. Thank you for your work.
Well, sisters, you know, this is college admissions time. And a long time ago, I used to be in college admissions and graduate business school admissions. So it's always a topic of interest. It's one that I've talked about a number of times here on Satellite Sisters. And it's very interesting this year because, like everything, the pandemic has upended the college admissions process. When you think about what you need to, you know, what to submit to go to colleges, it's grades, standardized test scores, recommendations, essays, and extracurricular activities. And that combination hasn't changed, but this year it has. That, you know, let's talk about grades. Starting in spring of 2020, we went to virtual schools. And for many people, that has remained through a year. And virtual schools mean virtual grades. So that it's going to be very difficult to evaluate students with GPAs that were earned in virtual school that, you know, versus being in the classroom. We really don't know what that means. But probably the other big thing is the cancellation of standardized tests, the SAT or the ACT, that over 1,600 schools and many highly selective schools have either, you know, they don't require the test anymore or it's optional. And that has created a completely different trend in, you know, admission 2021. It meant that many, many more, that applications to highly selective schools in general were up 17% on average. People applied to more colleges because they didn't have to submit test scores. Mm-hmm. And a school like Harvard, they saw a 42% increase in the number of applications.
Oh God.
Wow.
Yeah, I suppose people thought, well, why not? This is the year. If I ever had a shot, go for it.
I mean, Leon, you missed your opportunity. I mean, I know you attempted to apply to Harvard. You had good test scores, but you used a pencil to apply to Harvard the first time around.
That
right?
was a mistake.
I know that was. That was kind of a blunder, but you
I didn't know how to type. That was my biggest mistake in high school, is that I took extracurricular Latin instead of typing. And I was punished for that.
Okay, punished. Okay, I see you've gotten over it, which is really good. But so there's been this just massive increase in the number of people applying to college. But sadly, not all groups. Many underrepresented students are not applying to colleges. And there's actually a decrease in the number of students applying to community college and a decrease in the number of students applying for federal aid. But what has really gotten, you know, that I honed in on because I, you know, worked in admissions is the increased workload for many of these schools, where now there's, you know, they've seen this enormous increase in the number of applications. And they, in an article in the Wall Street Journal, they were saying at Williams, they were asking admissions readers to read between 45 to 50 applications a day. Okay, so you no longer can, you know, you have different grades because of the virtual school. You might not have test scores. You have recommendations and essays, and some, but you may not even have extracurricular activities because those have all been upended by the pandemic. But just imagine, let's say you're not an admissions officer. Let's say you're a doctor, and someone said you have to see 45 to 50 patients a day, and make a really big decision about this patient that will impact their lives. And you're not going to have all the information. Mm-hmm. You know, I think that in many ways, you know, some people are very happy that we're moving away from the standardized test. And there is, you know, certainly a lot of correlate, you know, the test is highly correlated with family wealth. I mean, there's a number of studies about that. And, you know, that I'm not sure that that's accurate. But in the absence of that, it just comes down to, you know, I don't know, a lot of personal judgment by the individual admissions officer that is taking a very short time to evaluate, you know, a student. So I have a new system that I want to propose. Okay. I'm thinking about this.
Good. Let's be solutions oriented here on Satellite Systems.
Yeah, I do. And I'm serious about this. I've been thinking about it. I really think we should go to some national lottery system. I think that, you know, creates some minimum standard that you have to have completed high school, completed all the coursework. Okay, maybe a minimum GPA. I don't know. And then just do a lottery. I think it would end up creating more access for more students to go to selective schools than what we're doing right now. I think that the system we have now is, you know, is not good, and it puts a lot of students at a clear disadvantage. And it's just, I don't think it's possible to make a good judgment 45 to 50 applications a day, you know, without test scores, you know, without accurate information. So,
you know what they always say in admissions, like, I mean, I've done a little bit of alumni admissions work for my alma mater, and they always say, like, we have more kids that are qualified to get in than we can let in.
Yes.
So in general, though, like, you know, as opposed to a doctor, I have to say it, I know it's not a life or death decision. You know, it's a slightly different thing.
But it's a big decision. All right.
It is a big decision. It's a big decision.
Yes. You know, it's not like letting people, you know, I mean, it is, it does have a, it's a decision with a lot of consequences.
Yes, for sure. Okay. Yes. And it, no, that's for sure. But a lot of people applying are still going to be qualified to get into that school and can still do the work when they get there, regardless of whatever happened with their COVID grades and things like that. So in general, like if they got their act together and completed these long, you know, applications, that's a self-selected pool. In a sense. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, we've talked about it a million times before. The system was crazy. The system that we had was crazy. It made people crazy. It made kids crazy. It involved a lot of money going to weird people and stuff like that. I don't know. I think to me, it's just a sign that the whole process has to be upended. So a lottery, sure. I mean, great.
Okay.
I think it's a pretty good idea.
Okay,
that's parents crazy. It will make parents crazy.
Well, everybody says it's a crapshoot anyway, Liam. Right. So let's just make it a crapshoot.
Just embrace it. Embrace it.
Okay, so that's two votes for the lottery. Three. Okay, that's good.
Because we've already been to college.
Low stakes vote for me. I've already been to college and I don't have any kids. So yeah, sure.
Okay, you're in.
Hey, Julie, right. I wanna recommend to you, though, I happened to listen to this week's episode of This American Life, and they covered college admissions this week. So they spoke to, like, the director of admissions at Yale and the director of admissions at Trinity College exactly about the issues you're talking about, like what changed with the SATs and all kinds of things. I think you would find it interesting. And then they did a really deep dive into the admission policy of UT Austin, which does not take standardized test scores and hasn't for a while. They just guarantee admission to the top 6% of everybody graduating from a Texas high school. And across all standards of high schools. So that mm-hmm. creates a lot of, you know, that creates an interesting applicant pool. And so it's really more about how you can keep those kids in. I think you'd enjoy that episode, Julie, particularly.
Okay, I will, because I am all about creating more access for a more diverse student body and getting away from the system we have.
Right.
And with that in mind, I have some homework for you two girls and for other Satellite Sisters, is I would highly recommend watching Operation Varsity Blues, the college admission scandal, which is now on Netflix.
Oh, is it good?
I know from our Facebook group that a number of our listeners have already watched it. It is very interesting. It's a very well done documentary. And this is on the major Department of Justice, FBI sting operation that involves celebrities, CEOs, lawyers, and other immoral wealthy people. that's not the way I would say it. It stars Matthew Modine as Rick Singer. And he was the ringleader. He had the corrupt college prep organization. But what is interesting about this documentary is they do reenactments with the actual wiretap conversations between Rick Singer and the wealthy clients, okay? And so you cannot make up this in terms of how these incredibly privileged people would call up Rick and they would, you know, they just wanted to know how to get their daughter in, but they didn't want their daughter to know that she was, you know, they were going to cheat on her SAT scores and they were going to make her into a water polo player or whatever. I mean, it is amazing to hear the actual transcripts and to see them redone. There's when you watch this at the end of it, I wanted to take a shower because you just feel like, wow, this is such a corrupt system. Here it is at college admissions, which already favors the wealthy because they're the ones that can afford, you know, a college counselor, the test prep, they can afford the fancy extracurricular activities, tutors, whatever they need. But still, these people wanted, you know, they just wanted to, I guess, you know, they wanted what their privilege has bought them in other areas. They were doing a deal and they wanted to secure their daughter or son into a prestigious university. And they were willing to write checks for $200,000, $500,000. So it's really well done. There's lots of different parts. A child that's applying to college, I think you would, you know, still find it a fascinating story about corruption, about, you know, how this is such, you know, part of our culture. But I will have to say, one of the, you know, in my mind, one of the unindicted co-conspirators of the whole Operation Varsity Blues has to be the universities, the colleges and the universities. Mm-hmm. I mean, yes, students get in the front door, as Rick would say. Students get in the back door if their parents can write a check for $20 million or $10 million for a building or a library. And then Rick created this side door where, you know, he sort of focused on niche sports like sailing and water polo or tennis. And he got these athletes in and had this whole system of corruption. So what is also interesting is that once the FBI busted Rick, he became an excellent undercover agent for the FBI and Department of Justice. He was a master salesman. So he then was wearing a wire, wearing a camera, and he would get all these clients to admit again, exact on tape, exactly what they had done. So he was highly effective in that role too. You know, he just, you know, so, but the worst part of it is I think it could happen again. And I don't think college admissions has changed that much. I don't know since this whole episode with, the Operation Varsity Blues was exposed. I think there will continue to be backdoors into colleges and universities. And it's a pity because at one point a college admissions counselor says, you know, said in the movie, there are 3,000 different excellent colleges across the United States, and this frenzy to get into, you know, a hand
20. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's not worth it. It is just not worth it. It's, you know, and you can get a very good education. And I think this is what a number of people in our Facebook group said, at a smaller colleges as well. So it's well worth watching, you know, a lot of things to think about. I don't know, you know, I think we need a lottery system. Okay. That's all I'm gonna say.
let's just blow it up. It's like burning all your furniture. Let's blow up college admissions. Yeah. It's time to make some radical change, people. Okay, so that's a documentary on Netflix. Good good recommendation, Julie. Operation Varsity Blues. I want to make a quick comment on some movies I'm recommending. And I was thinking of what I'm calling the upside of the downside. Because I really, 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 really miss going to movie theaters. I love seeing movies in movie theaters. But obviously, that's not happening. But as a result, the upside of the downside is that some of these smaller indie movies that you wouldn't normally have had access to, if say in your city, there's not a good sort of indie movie theater, they're all streaming now. So three of them, which I've seen and I would totally recommend, they've really stuck with me. You've heard of all of these movies, but now is your chance to see Nomadland. If you have Hulu, it's on Hulu. And it's Frances McDormand is great, and it just raises a lot of interesting issues of class and economic gaps. That movie's really stuck with me. Minari, I saw that last weekend. That's the movie about the Korean immigrants who moved to the American South. It's a fascinating and beautiful movie. I really recommend that. Julie, there's an especially poignant grandmother-grandson relationship that is just the cutest. It's just a lovely part of that movie. So you can see that on Amazon. And also on Amazon, The Sound of Metal, starring Riz Ahmed, which is something you might not normally go see. It's about like a punk rock musician who loses his hearing. It's really, the Riz Ahmed performance is great, but also the issues that it raises about deafness as a disability and what that means culturally. Again, like it's days after I saw it and I'm still thinking about that movie. So there you go. The upside of the downside is if you have these streaming services, see Nomadland, see Minari, and see The Sound of Metal. This is the year. And then next year, you can go back to your Marvel universe. Fine. Go ahead. And then also I watched, because you guys had recommended, these three movies, by the way, they're not exactly mood lifters, but they're, you know. But so then I took in all of Ted Lasso. I just watched every single episode of Ted Lasso.
Good for you, Liz.
Could not have loved more. There you go. That's my report.
Well, Liz, I know we have a lot of Ted Lasso fans, so I'm excited to report that they're doing a Ted Lasso night at Paley Fest. That is the TV festival that we've mentioned many times on Satellite Sisters. Again, we usually go in person and get to see the writers and actors and EPs of these TV shows, talk about them. It's for super fans and it's lots of fun, but it's all online this year and it's all free. So I'm going to put that link in the show notes and I'll spread it around Satellite Sisters and in Pep Talk, our newsletter, if you're not signed up for that, because if, you know, they did the whole cast of The Queen's Gambit, and coming up this week is Ted Lasso, I'm looking forward to that. Definitely going to tune in. All right, you guys, that's a super full show. We have to go. Sorry. Yeah.
Okay.
I'm sorry.
No,
we have to go. But first, we'd like to thank Sergio Enriquez for engineering our show. Thank you, Sergio. We'd like to thank Emily Loudermilk for creating the great graphics that go with Satellite Sisters. You've seen them on our Instagram and in Pep Talk. Thank you, Emily. We appreciate it. We so appreciate our sponsors, and we appreciate you for supporting those sponsors. That's what keeps our show on the air and allows us to do this. Thank you very much. All right, Julie, what's on your to-do list?
I am playing Trivial Pursuit 1981 version with my grandchildren. And you know what? I'm killing it because
that was your year.
Yeah. I'm doing really well. They think I'm a genius. So I'm going to continue to play the 1981 version of this game. Yeah.
All right. I am considering a new scalloped potato recipe for Easter. Oh. So stand by on that. Oh, okay. My friend Susan texted me the one from Martha Stewart's magazine. It looked like a nice meal in general. It involves cheddar cheese. I've never put cheddar in scalloped potatoes. So I'm deciding whether I want to go that way or go more traditional. So it's a huge week for me. Huge week. Liz, what's on your to-do?
Well, I'm getting in touch with my inner Lindsay Vonn sisters. You know, she's rehabbed herself back from so many accidents. That's what I'm working on because I have a follow-up meeting with my surgeon on Thursday. Leanne, you've been a witness to these meetings as we've been going through this. He's super mean.
And he's not warm.
He's not warm. You know, he's an orthopedic surgeon. It's not his job to be warm, but he is. He's tough. He's tough. So my goal is to get through the meeting without crying. That's my goal.
You can do it.
Yes. So
mine too, then. I'll try not to cry this time too.
And for that, I need to get in touch with my inner Lindsay Vonn. She can do it. I can do it. I'm doing it, sisters. That's what I'm doing.
All right. Love it. Okay, sisters, have a great week.
You too, Leanne.
And don't forget, call your satellite sister.